again. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Our guest this hour is the author of And Good Night to All, The Beautiful Young Women, a tale of episodic dementia, the parent becomes the child. Joel Kreofsky is with us, and the book is about caring for his father, a former FBI special agent, and he has incredible stories to tell about his career. He is entering the last 19 months of his life, suffering from cancer and from episodic dementia. And Joel also writes about their relationship as Joel was growing up and feeling that he could never please his father. Many people I know in the audience have been through the experience of caring for a father or a mother while he or she was dying, and you become a caretaker. And it's really a very difficult time in life and a very important time for everybody involved, I think. Joel is a graduate of Marquette University College of Journalism. He spent many years working in print and broadcast. His essay, My Father, the G-Man, was published in Milwaukee Magazine. He was one of his father's principal caregivers throughout his entire hospice. And we'll be, as we carry on our conversation, welcoming phone calls. And here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. Joel, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You describe your father so well because you do have the image of him as you read the book of his being this vital FBI important guy who was involved in so many cases, but you start the book with believing what your eyes are seeing when you see him in a hospital having just had surgery for stomach cancer.
Yes, yeah, he was, he looked like he was going to collapse or cash it in at any moment, and so we were very surprised when he recovered from that form of cancer due to a surgical bowel resection.
Oh.
And ultimately, of course, liver cancer claimed him.
Mm-hmm. But he was, when you saw him given a diagnosis, that he wasn't going to live very long, right?
Yeah, his oncologist thought that he would succumb a lot quicker than he did. In fact, we had to have him recertified a couple of times for hospice care because you're not supposed to live that long if you're dying of two forms of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
But he made it a total of 19 months.
Mm-hmm. And he was in a care facility for a while.
He was at St. Camillus for a short time, and unhappily so. So my sister and I decided we'd take him home, and he lived at my sister's house until he finally died.
Mm-hmm. And you decided that your family members, your sister and you, were going to be able to take care of him. That's a difficult thing to do.
Yeah, well, my wife Mary and I came into caregiving probably in the mid-80s. We took care of a dying sister-in-law who had pancreatic cancer. Mm. So I guess it kind of led us on a path of caregiving, ultimately giving care to all four of our parents in various forms, and a pair of brothers-in-law and another sister-in-law and others.
Mm. So. Well, a long period of caregiving
for you and
your wife.
So. It was something we felt obligated to do, and I hope we did it reasonably well.
In addition to the stomach cancer and to dealing with that and having to care for him, which means all kinds of caring for him, he also had episodic dementia. What was that?
Well, we called it episodic dementia. I'm sure that's not a correct term, but it was one with which we became familiar. There were many episodes in which he would exhibit different behaviors and almost different personalities. Shall I give you an example?
Please do.
Through one extended period of time, well after he retired from the FBI, he would call me in the middle of the night, 2, 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning, and he would ask me my FBI assignment for the day, assuming that we were fellow agents.
Oh.
And he'd say, What's your assignment, Joey? He always called me Joey. And for a long time, I would simply say, would you go back to bed? You're hallucinating. You're dreaming. It's the middle of the night. But he'd call back 5 minutes later. So then ultimately, I learned to play along. So if he said, what was your assignment? I'd say, I guess I'm assigned to the county grounds. We're searching for communist infiltrators.
Oh, no.
And he'd say, well, who's your partner? And I'd say, well, Agent Lozinski or Agent Shesnikevich or whatever. And he'd say, what squad are you assigned to? I'd say, MI-29 or, you know, he'd say, oh, that's a good squad. And he said, Lozinski's a good man. And that would ultimately appease him, and he'd go back to bed.
Oh. So every now and then you would have to say things. I know you took drives around town and he would be remarking on things and then forget that he had said them and remark on the same thing a few minutes later.
Yeah, one of the episodes I call in the book Twin Cities,
mm-hmm.
He had been visiting a stepson, my sister's stepson, so his step-grandson, I guess, if that's correct. And so he'd spent some time in the Twin Cities, in Minneapolis and St. Paul, I guess, even the Mall of America. And we had the duty this particular weekend and had breakfast with him, and then we took him out, which he liked to do. We'd take him out riding in the car, and we'd point out Marquette High School, where he and I both went to high school, and Marquette University. He had a law degree from MU. And I from its College of Journalism. So we'd point all of these things out. And ultimately, we'd work our way down to the old federal building where he had his FBI offices. But at one point, he got this kind of wild look in his eyes. And he said, I can't believe it. Marquette, you, MUHS, the federal building, this is exactly like the buildings in Milwaukee. And we'd say, Dad, you're in Milwaukee. No, we're not. This is amazing. All of these places look precisely like the buildings in Milwaukee. I said, perhaps you were still thinking you're in Minnesota. No, he said, you got to call the papers. You got to call the radio station. So I'd get out of the car, park along the curb, go to a phone booth, and I'd pretend to call the newspapers and the radio stations. And I got back to the car, and I said, look, everybody's been notified. Paper, radio. He said, good, let's get to the tavern.
And that's where you would go. And the tavern stories are many as well. Although, you know, some would say, are you sure you should have taken him to a tavern? And we'll talk about why you made the decision to do so, because he was probably a certifiable alcoholic.
Yes.
And you were too, but you weren't drinking.
That's correct.
Yeah. Right.
Well, we really reasoned that this was one of few sensory pleasures available to him, and it wasn't going to do him any harm at this point. And he wasn't really overdoing it. But one story I like to tell is about going to a tavern that he really enjoyed on Capitol Drive in the 90s. And I would always prime the bartender. I'd say, look, my dad lives in the 50s and 40s, and he thinks every beer and shot of brandy ought to be worth about 50 cents or a quarter, respectively. So I said, look, I'm going to put some money on the bar. And just take my money, and when it comes to his round, take my money, but maybe surreptitiously grab a 50 cents from his stash, and then he'll be happy, and he won't start yelling at you and calling you a crook or saying your prices are confiscatory. So I told this story to the tavern owner, whom I knew quite well, and he went along with it and said, oh, my gosh, the man's a treat and a relic, but he would take my cash, and my father would say to me, why not, when he had to pay his 50 cents or a quarter for a boomba and a shot of brandy, he'd say, now, Joey, this is a proper saloon. They know how to charge people.
But then one time you went to the bathroom, and he was dealing with the bartender by himself. That was a scene.
Right. We were coming back from his trip to see my older brother in Texas, and we stopped at the Bratstop in Kenosha, and I got him situated at the bar and went into the men's room, and eventually came back, and I heard all of this hubbub, and he was really getting angry because they were taking a lot more money than he expected they should or would, and he was calling the bartender and the day manager, gangsters, crooks, and thieves.
Gee.
And I took the manager aside and I said, look, my father is an old man. He probably crawled out of the primordial ooze. He's that old. And he doesn't realize that things are supposed to cost $1.50 or so for a bottle of beer. He thinks that's really outrageous. So I simply forgot to prime you. I normally do that when I take them in the taverns. I forewarn the managers and the bartenders to take my money. And he said, well, he really offended my bartender. I said, well, he didn't mean it. He's an old man. And so that was, I finally got him calmed down. And then the rest of the drinks were taken out of my stash.
Right.
He was trying very hard to make me go broke, but...
He always had, there's nothing beating a sense of humor in life, right? I mean, if you've got a sense of humor, you can get through a lot of this. And you, in your eulogy for him, said that this guy should have been a comedian. That got him through. It probably got you through a lot as well.
Well, he had reference the movie Goodfellas, where the Joe Pesci character says to somebody, you're a funny guy, Joe, or something like that. But my father was more than just a funny guy. He was remarkably gifted as a humorist, comedian, and storyteller. In fact, most of his FBI career, or at least probably the second half of it, he spent as a teacher trainer of police and sheriff's departments all over the Midwest. And because he was so gifted at storytelling and comedy, they loved him. They loved him. And he was well-respected throughout the Midwest for his teaching and training FBI methods to these various departments. And it served me in good stead, because when I'd get picked up for maybe excessive speed and I produced my driver's license, they'd say, oh, are you related to Joe Kriofsky? Yeah, that's my father, the FBI, the former FBI man. I said, well, go ahead on your way, but just be careful.
yeah, connections are everything.
Right,
they are. How did he ever enter the FBI? It's an unusual career, really.
He got his law degree, and I think he was not thrilled with practicing law, although he did for, I don't know, maybe a year or two. But in conversations with his Marquette U fellow classmates, I think a couple of them or a few of them decided to go in the FBI. They thought it would be a more exciting career. And one of his great friends, Joe Brock, joined the FBI around the same time. And he was killed in New York City by an infamous bank robber. But he liked the career. He liked the various assignments he had. He was very instrumental in capturing a Nazi saboteur.
Yeah, tell us that story. That was fascinating.
I can't remember the name of the Haupt was his name, the actual saboteur. He and a group of Nazis landed aboard submarines, one in New Jersey and another crewful in Florida. And they made their way to their various targets in Chicago in the East. And they were ultimately turned in and captured, I think, by some of their fellow saboteurs who simply got cold feet. And anyway, my father helped capture the younger Haupt, but his parents shielded and sheltered him in Chicago, and they were ultimately arrested and charged with treason. But he, my father, and a fellow agent or two actually captured the younger Haupt and the parents, and some other saboteurs as well. And that resulted in their either execution or very long-term prison sentences.
Would he tell you these stories when you were growing up, or did he hold it close to his chest?
Some of the stories when he got quite a bit older and after he retired. But most of them he would keep fairly close to his chest. I remember, if I may tell you this story, when my brother and I were kids, my father on Sunday mornings after church would take us to a tavern called Rosie Sluga's on about 19th in Lisbon, where he would meet his mole double agents. You know, they're all wearing their gray felt or brown fedoras, and we were his cover, my brother and I. So we'd sit patiently drinking pop and eating candy bars and having a good time while my father met with and conferred with his double agents, his communist infiltrators.
Fascinating. Yeah. And speaking of communists, he went to school with Joseph McCarthy.
He did, yeah. And he always admired Joe McCarthy. I remember one time I had written a paper in college about Joe McCarthy and his character assassination throughout his career. And my father became quite agitated and angry with me for denigrating and belittling his one of his idols, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it, as you were looking at in your reflections on growing up with your dad and how it wasn't always easy, he didn't think you were tough enough, athletic enough. Mm-hmm. I really was struck by, we'll get to that scene in a moment, but that you had time at least at the end so that you could find this amount of respect for him and appreciate his humor. And even though there were a lot of hard, difficult times, you could tell that the two of you were doing okay at the end.
We did. We did very well. I think our relationship morphed into something far more like friendship and mutual respect. I think it started when I came out of the military, although we didn't spend a great deal of time together toward the end of his life during his hospice period. We talked a lot about his career, my military service.
Where were you?
I was stationed in, I started out in the Air Force at Lackland, went to a trade school to learn something called non-Morse intercept. It was code breaking. And then I went to Turkey for a year and a half, where we listened in on the Russians and other communist bloc countries and tried to discover unknown and new electronic radio systems and then try to break the intelligence out of them. And that was a very interesting time. And my father enjoyed hearing those stories. And we did, in fact, I think, sort of resurrect respect and friendship for one another. And it carried us through that long hospice caregiving period.
Yeah, I'm sure it did. But when you were young, I was struck by the story of, we'll weave your mother into this as well. Your mother, brushing your mother's hair, mm-hmm. is something I love to do for my mom all the time, too, is brush her hair. And your father found that to be a very sissy thing for you to be doing.
Yeah, he became very angry with me. He started cursing at me and telling me not to be a sissy and a queer and other terms of opprobrium. He sure could. He had a great gift for language, too. And my mother would simply say, oh, just don't pay any attention to him. But those were obviously difficult and rather hurtful times for a youngster. But I got over it and forgot about it and tried to realize what his own history and background had been, and realized that his FBI career obviously colored some of his some of his attitudes and ideas.
Yeah. And yet your mother was Jewish.
She was. She did not practice Judaism at all. She practiced no religion, and she kept her own family history rather guarded, as my father was wildly anti-Semitic.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. But her father, her family had a very interesting history, and she had relatives, a nephew perhaps, who had been in the camps. And so we came to this knowledge rather later in our lives and found it quite fascinating, and I tried to embrace a piece of my own heritage as a result of learning about that history.
Mm-hmm. So. Did that create tension in their relationship at all?
You know, I don't know, but I don't think so, because my mother never really paraded her Jewish heritage. I think she kept it, as her father did, and her mother kept it rather secretive and guarded. Mm-hmm. My grandfather, my maternal grandfather, abandoned Judaism early on in his life, and I think it was because of the harsh treatment he received being brought up in a synagogue. He was, in a sense, sort of deeded to a synagogue by a very poor agrarian father, and because he had musical talent, he became a valuable commodity and ultimately a cantor. And was a principal part of a musical tradition in this synagogue that traveled all over Europe, presenting music and song.
And for how many years, if it was years, was your father alive after your mother died?
Let me see. She died in 1990. He died in 96. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The other stories that were actually kind of scary when you think about it, to have a dad as an FBI agent, he had a gun with him all the time, but there was a instance you describe in the book where you're a kid and you're finding the gun and grabbing it, which God knows it could have been loaded. You could have killed yourself.
Yeah, I can't remember if it was loaded or not, but I took it down and I was sort of playing with it in the dining room on the desk, and he came in and saw that, and he became very angry with me and said, the things a father would say, give me that and don't ever touch it again. Those things can kill people.
Right.
And I don't know if it was loaded. It may well have been.
Ooh, but, that's frightening.
But he always kept it in a certain place. After that, he
right,
I'm sure he kept
didn't.
It in a place that was well hidden from his sons.
We hope he locked it up.
Yeah.
So let's go back to the beginning of the book where you've got this diagnosis and he's out of the rehab center and he's at home and you're visiting him and your sister's taking care of him. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden he needs to be dressed. He needs to be bathed.
Right.
So was that something that you thought at any point, I can't really do this?
You know, I never really thought I approached it reluctantly, certainly, and that's to be truthful. But I never found it so daunting that I couldn't do it. I mean, we took care of his dressing and toileting, and when my sister wasn't there, Mary and I would have
Mary,
the
your
duty,
wife.
Yes, mm-hmm. Would have the duty and spend weekends with him. And but I never really found it to be a terrible ordeal. It was just part of caregiving, I mm-hmm. thought, and he was never reluctant to have those. Caregiving and ablutions handled for him, so we approached it, I think, very very matter-of-factly. It was mm-hmm. never a great issue or a problem mm-hmm. for us.
And did he deteriorate over those 19 months, or were you able to get a good number of days where you could take drives and go to the bars?
He did deteriorate to the point where he was pretty much housebound, but for most of the time, I would say he was, with help, pretty ambulatory and enjoyed those times riding in the car and just being with us and my endless prattle as the ersatz tour guide. But I think he just enjoyed getting out of the house. And then he knew the great reward at the end of our days out would be at some tavern or another that he always enjoyed, and he would talk to everybody. And the one story I found quite fascinating, one episode, was the gunfight. That's in a chapter where I picked him up in the morning. I would often take him to his doctor appointments. He'd mm-hmm. see his oncologist and his vascular surgeon on a fairly regular basis because I was self-employed. I was able to take care of those duties. And he got in the car and he was absolutely wild-eyed, and he'd say, "Joey, did you listen to the radio? Did you read the paper about the gunfight we were in last night? And your mother, I can't believe she could handle a gun that well. She was mowing them down and shooting them out from second-story windows, and they were hitting the pavement." And I said, "Well, wait a minute. You've got to be dreaming about this." He said, No. "What, don't you read the papers? What's the matter with you? Are you stupid or something? This was a real gunfight. Commies and infiltrators and gangsters and miscreants." And I'd say, "Well, look, we're going to the doctor now." And he was using a lot of the N-word describing some of these miscreants. And I'd say, "Look, when we get to Frederick, would you please avoid telling this story to the nurses? Because a lot of these nice women who work with the doctors are African-American." And I said, "Oh, and besides, the FBI may not want you to divulge all this information. This could be really secretive, really top secret stuff. So please just keep it under your hat." And he said, "All right, well, fine." So then we finally did get to the hospital and got him checked in, and the nurses greeted us. And he didn't say a word about that, but he did say, "Oh, I want you to meet my brother, Roman." I'd say, I'd take the nurses aside, and I'd say, "Listen, in order to be his brother, Roman, I'd have to be 93 and dead."
So, oh, what What a character. We'll continue and welcome phone calls as well. I know that many of you listening, because I hear from you, and we've been through, many of us, taking care of a parent as he or she is dying. And Joel just had a father who was a guy filled with stories and good humor, even though they had a fairly difficult time of it when he was young. And he's written about the experience of helping his dad after surgery for stomach cancer. His father also had what they were calling episodic dementia. So it's a tale, the book is, and Goodnight to All the Beautiful Young Women, a tale of episodic dementia. The parent becomes the child. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. We'd love to have you share your experiences of what it was like for you to take on the caring for a child who actually was your father or your mother. This is the Ideas Network. Tomorrow during this hour, how should journalists treat those non-factual statements given by politicians and others without appearing as being biased themselves, or even worse, giving attention to something that is not true? Tomorrow at this time, we'll speak with a journalism professor who offers advice on how to go beyond fact-checking, and we think that you'll enjoy that conversation. As I'm sure you are, this one as well. I don't know if you've had a chance to read Joel's book, but I'm interested in hearing from you because I've been through taking care of parents who are dying as well, and I know many of you have, and there's a lot of wonderful advice for people who are going through a similar process in Joel's book. If you're in the middle of it, it might be a good book for you to be reading. And Goodnight to All the Beautiful Young Women, A Tale of Episodic Dementia, The Parent Becomes the Child. Our phone number, or you can just listen, that's fine too, is 800-486-8655. And Joel, you're reading the book for the library. You wanted to mention that?
Yes. We were invited by Executive Director Cheryl Orgas of the Audio and Braille Literacy Enhancement Program to record and read the book. At least I will. The book will be read by somebody.
Well,
and
it has
possibly,
to be you.
Possibly
listen
by
to you.
Me.
You know,
but,
your storytelling.
But I still have to audition to see if they think I'm competent to read properly.
I think you'll pass.
In a recording. But it goes out to, their recordings go out to the Wisconsin Talking Book and Braille Library, and it makes the book available to 550,000 blind and physically handicapped people throughout the nation. So mm-hmm. It's a real privilege to have been invited to do that.
I'm sure it is. It's a wonderful thing that they're doing. It's just great.
It is.
And they built a recording studio at the library.
They have. They have an excellent facility.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure you'll... All you have to do is present this interview as your audition, and they'll say, he has a great voice, and that guy can tell a story, right?
Well, thank you very much.
And they'll say, okay, no doubt about it. Yeah. Let's talk about some of the harder things that happened here, because so far we've concentrated on, which it, as it should be, the moments of humor that you found with your dad. But obviously there was a lot of baggage that the two of you had, too. He wasn't an easy person. He didn't seem particularly close when you were young. He had a heavy-duty career, which I sure took him on the road a lot. You weren't a big sports guy like your brother was, and your father didn't like that because he was. How do you get from a point where your childhood may be problematic to you find yourself at a time when you're taking care of your dying father?
Well, I think part of the intervening years in which I had joined the military and getting away from my family, getting away from my father, was very helpful, and it helped me to acquire I reacquired some self-esteem somewhere down the road and sort of forgot about the difficult times, but. But I did tend to avoid him. My sister euphemistically used to say he wasn't quite the family man about my father, which was a nice way of putting it. He was brilliant and charming and a great raconteur, and his friends, his fellow FBI agents, absolutely loved him, and he was always very entertaining to his friends and his coworkers, but not so much to his family. So I think we we tried really hard to avoid one another. And I lived on my own. I really never returned home again, so to speak, after coming out of the military and going on to college. I tried really hard to live on my own, support myself in some fashion or another with the help of the GI Bill. So when we did spend time together, it was usually him calling me to ask me to repair something. My father and a hammer were never friends. We're never familiar with one another. He would he was totally unacquainted with anything resembling manual labor. So whenever anything needed to be done, he would call me, and I would do that fairly willingly, because for my mother as well, who was a kind, sweet, generous person, so I didn't mind doing those things. But I didn't really like interacting with my father, although there were times when he could be very gracious and humorous. On those occasions when I was invited home for dinner, he wouldn't talk directly to me. He'd say to my mother, his name was Helen, he'd say, "Helen, ask the boy if he wants some more peas."
Oh, no.
So my mother would patiently, calmly say, "He's right in front of you. You can talk directly to him. Ask the lad if he wants some more potatoes, Helen." And then she'd chide him, and he'd say, "Don't talk, Helen. Don't talk."
Oh, no. So,
but there were many times when he could be very mean-spirited and offensive. He was never physically abusive, but his verbal command of language made it possible for him to be very effectively verbally abusive, and those were hard times. So as I said, I really tried hard to avoid having a lot to do with him, only on those occasions when it was absolutely necessary. But then, as we've discussed previously, later on, we did seem to find a form of communication and friendship.
Did he ever talk about those earlier years? Did he ever say, "I wish I had spent more time with you. I'm sorry for some
never,
of the things"?
Never. Interestingly, my brother, who was a pretty gifted athlete, after having read the book, revealed to me something I hadn't really realized, that my mother and father never once went to one of his football games.
Really?
Yeah, never.
Oh my goodness.
And my father was a great football player in throughout high school, high school and college. He was team captain of the basketball team at Marquette High, and went on to play semi-pro ball when he was in his early years of pre-law. But yeah, never.
Why was that?
I just don't think he wanted to have, seemed not to want to have a lot of interaction with his children. I don't know why. But that was hard. That was a difficult thing to accept for the three of us, for my sister, brother, and myself.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
And you took that to heart and became a different kind of dad.
I did. I tried very hard to give my own children, and now my grandchildren, all of the love and attention I think they're entitled to and that they need, and I think my own sense of humor has helped me along that pathway as well.
Mm-hmm. So. And what about your father and his grandchildren? Was he closer to them than to
you?
Yeah,
he was a much better grandfather than he was a father. And our children still talk about the happy times that they spent with him when he was, because he was very funny. He was very funny and engaging and gracious to them. I think he learned how to, I think after his FBI years were done, he found a way to engage more with children and younger people.
Mm. Was he afraid to die?
You know, he never expressed any fear. I think because of the dementia, perhaps, he never had a full realization that he was actually dying, even though we'd tell him constantly that he was sick and had these had forms of cancer that were debilitating. In fact, one time when I took him to see his doctors on one of the regular visits, he would say to me, "Joey, why do you always have to see so many doctors?" And I'd say to him, "Actually, it's not me seeing the doctors. It's we're seeing them for you. He said, oh, well, all right, fine. You know, and he'd ask me why, and I'd try to explain it to him in his calm and friendly a way as possible, so as not to terrify him about what was going on in his body.
Hmm. Were you terrified by it? Because he it's hard to see. It's hard to see when your parent just becomes debilitated.
It was hard when he was very obviously diminishing in his he was losing weight and turning more sort of gray in color and his pallor and so forth. He was that was hard to see. That was hard to watch. And his spirits were always really quite good in those days and throughout that entire hospice period.
Mm-hmm. And going back to the drinking thing, was it hard for you to sit there at all these taverns and not drink?
Sometimes it was, I don't know. Most times, I don't think it really. I guess I had been several years sober at that period, and so I was used to tavern life, and I was used to being with people who still were in the drinking culture, and sipping my diet colas. I didn't find it difficult until people really started getting a little bit overserved and obnoxious, then I really sort of wanted to get out of there. But with my father, in our experiences, his capacity for consumption of alcohol wasn't that great anymore. So he would have two or three beers and maybe two or three shots of brandy. And by that time, he was really ready to take his afternoon nap or go home and have dinner.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't these protracted periods of time where we had to sit in the taverns and just endure the long bouts of drinking, because they really weren't that long.
What about when you were a child? Did you have problems with his drinking then?
Again, we were so inured to taverns as the social club in his culture.
Mm-hmm.
That, and if, as long as somebody was buying us pop and candy bars, we would sit and enjoy the time and play games or play the electronic games, whatever they happened to be, the bowling game and so forth at the various taverns we visited. So it wasn't that difficult as a child. And the people he knew and the people he met and with whom he interacted were always very entertaining and funny and jolly and a bit silly and crazy, so we sort of enjoyed it.
Let's welcome phone calls, and we have people calling in now. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and you can also send an email if you'd like, talk@wpr.org. Joel Kreofsky is our guest. He is the author of And Good Night to All the Beautiful Young Women, A Tale of Episodic Dementia, The Parent Becomes the Child. Let's start with David in Wausau. Hello, David.
Yes, great show, Joy and Joel. I have a story about an event that happened. My mother, who was 88 when she died, but she died from lingering vascular dementia. She had three plus years when this happened, and my father's name was John, and he died about a year before my mother. And when this happened, my brother and I, the only two of nine children that were local here in Wausau and had the privilege of taking care of both of them in their final years, and when this event I'm about to describe happened, she had not uttered an intelligible sentence for, I'm going to say about a year and a half.
Mm.
And, she would utter excitement, and once in a while you'd get a I love you out of her, but never a complete sentence, at least in my presence, until this happened. And my brother and I, our typical evening was one of the two of us had dinner with her every night at the facility she was in and put her to bed.
Oh, that was nice.
Yeah, it was very special. And putting her to bed consisted of lifting her out of her wheelchair, and she was a small woman. She was probably about 85 pounds, dripping wet when she passed on. But it was my turn to put her to bed this night. And like I said, I hadn't heard a sentence for a year and a half. And at the time this happened, it's also important to note that she would call both my brother and I John when she did come up with a name, and we could both be standing in front of her, and she'd call us both John, my father's name. And so it was my night to put her to bed, and I lifted her up out of the wheelchair and put her down to bed like I always did, and stroked her forehead and her arm until she'd go off to sleep. And she had been clicking her teeth, which is a typical dementia thing. Her father, her husband was a dentist, so she had all her teeth when she died. And it's a nervous energy expression, typical of the disease, and where she could click her teeth so loud you could hear her across the hallway, across the room. And when I put her to bed this night, she was clicking her teeth, and it didn't really bother me that much, but my brother had said he had had some luck being direct with her. And as more of an experiment than anything, I certainly wasn't exasperated. I had been doing this for 6 months already. I put her down, and she was clicking her teeth, and I decided to try out my brother's theory, and I leaned down, and we were almost nose to nose, and I said, "Mom, stop it." And, of course, she stopped it for about 15 seconds. And she relaxed back into the pillow. And in about 5 more seconds, she brought her head up off the pillow, stuck her nose to my nose, and she said, and I'm not exaggerating, she said, "Now you see what I've been putting up with all these years."
No, it's amazing what can happen at any time of life.
Great story.
Yeah, it is a great story. Thank you so much, David, for your call. Bob in Madison is next. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Hi,
I'm
Bob.
Wondering, Joel, if you have an idea of how much his dementia was caused by alcohol.
Great question. I don't really have an idea, but my guess is that it certainly was exacerbated by his use of alcohol and his alcoholism. And I haven't studied that much about Alzheimer's and incipient style and dementia generally, but I'm guessing that that lifestyle is a great contributing factor to the problems of regressing dementia.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Bob, for the call.
Thank you.
A few listeners have called to ask where the book is available. Is it in local bookstores, at the library? What about online?
Online through Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and BooksAMillion.com. It's available through all three sites. And there were copies at Boswell Books. I don't know if they're sold out or not. The last I heard, they were sold out. There are a few copies at Little Red Book in Wauwatosa. And I think that's about it. Oh, yes, there are copies available at the Milwaukee Public Library East, the East Side Library.
Okay. More phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number. The book is "And Good Night to All the Beautiful Young Women, A Tale of Episodic Dementia, The Parent Becomes the Child." This is the Ideas Network. Let's talk about the time right before your dad was to pass away. I think that's a really hard time. I don't know if he was at a time where he couldn't speak or talk very much, and you didn't. I think that was the case where you were talking to him because he wasn't able to talk to you, and you were just holding his hand and telling him what.
I was. I guess I was sort of prattling on and asking him where we went right and where we went wrong, as in the early part of our relationship, and when I was growing up. And I just talking to him and saying, did I disappoint you? Were there times when I did something that made you very, very unhappy or angry? Well, I knew there were, of course, because I was a recalcitrant youth acting out and doing naughty things when I was a kid. But a lot of it was just my sort of monologue on what he was like, what he wanted for himself and for his family in his earlier years. I remember asking him about his law career and his early days in the FBI, which of his cases he found most interesting and gratifying. Just a lot of monologue, kind of one-sided. And every once in a while, I'd see his eye twitch, or he'd give me a half smile, or he seemed to try to speak, but nothing came out. I remember when he was actually dying and in bed, I was holding his hand. That was the most pervasive moment of this sort of monologue, where I was just holding his hand and talking at him, so to speak, and hoping for a response, but getting none. And that was difficult, but it was also a very kind of a gratifying, loving time, and just kind of watching him fade away. But it was also obviously very sad and troubling.
Yeah. And then I know that you were sad, and your sister was crying, and his grandson as well, that you know it's going to happen, but when it happens, it's just,
right.
Sadness can be overwhelming.
Yeah, yeah. And it was. And even though you're all prepared for it, especially after so lengthy a period of illness and hospice, you know it's going to happen, but when it happens, it's still quite a shock.
Yeah, it is. My dad was in a facility. I couldn't get him to move up here in Illinois, and I was going back and forth and back and forth, he was in a coma in the last 2 days, and life is so weird, isn't it, Joel, that the day that he died, and this was true of his wedding, Notre Dame, he loved Notre Dame. You couldn't walk in the living room if Notre Dame was on. I mean, mm-hmm. he would yell at you and yell at you. So to this day, I can't stand football. But he loved football, and on his dying day, Notre Dame was playing UCLA, the very same matchup that occurred on his wedding day back in 1946, and he wasn't sure he was going to be able to get through the ceremony because he had to know the score of the game. So here I am doing a play-by-play of the Notre Dame football game to my dad, thinking, by God, this guy can hear. I hope he can hear every word. I'm massacring this, but what a thing. This is what I'm doing as he's dying.
Well, good for you. That's very commendable, Kathleen, that you've taken such loving care of your own father. That's great.
Yeah, I just don't watch football, though, I must say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's go to Mary in Elm Grove next. Hello, Mary.
Hello, Kathleen. It's so nice to talk to you and to Joel. I actually know Joel. I grew up down the block from you, Joel. I was one of the Clary girls.
Hi, Mary. How are you?
Hi. It's been years.
It has.
It's so good to talk
great.
To you also.
Wonderful to hear your voice.
Yes. Well, my mother had Alzheimer's, and it just progressed so quickly. I remember one time in particular, taking her to my house. I was an adult then, and as we got closer to my house, I thought she was not as far gone as she was, and the one thing she said to me was, "Oh, you must know my daughter Mary. She lives near here." And that was the first time I realized that she really didn't know who I was anymore. So that was a shocker.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's nothing easy about Alzheimer's, so I hope they find a cure.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah. I remember hearing about those episodes from your sister Kathy and your brother John.
Yes. And you know, I spent a lot of time in your house because I was good friends with your sister, and I don't ever remember meeting or seeing your father there.
Really?
So, yeah, so one of the, yeah, of course, maybe I was there when he was working, but I don't ever remember meeting him. But my Uncle Frank was in the FBI and was friends with your dad, so I think I may have seen him at my uncle's house once, but that's about it.
Yeah. They spent a lot of time together, and they spent a lot of time working, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And investigating things, and as our, I don't know if your mother had the same, or no, I'm sorry, if Frank's wife Mary if your Auntie Mary had the same had the same euphemistic comment. But my mother used to say about men who went to taverns habitually, she would say, "You know, he stops." Does your husband stop? You know, and that was their way of saying, "Oh yeah, he's at Joe and Sophie's, or he's at the Fin and the Feather, or something like that."
Oh, it's amazing listening. Yeah,
I remember him coming home and putting his gun up in the upper shelf. So right. Remember that too.
That's where it should be locked away. Thank you so much for calling, Mary. And Joel, thank you so much for being with us. It was, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. Yeah. It's been a privilege and a pleasure to be with you. Yeah. I really appreciate it.
You as well. The book is And Good Night to All the Beautiful Young Women, A Tale of Episodic Dementia. The Parent Becomes the Child. You spell Joel's last name KRIOFSKE. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee, a building that Joel's dad will remember because it was new then, the Noxema building, the federal building on Wisconsin Avenue. Thanks, everybody, for your calls. We'll be with you again tomorrow.